The U.S. economy is at an inflection point. That's according to Fed Chair Jay Powell. What does that mean for the financial markets? Joining us to talk about that is Phil Camparelli. He's a portfolio manager at JP Morgan Asset Management. Phil, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
It's great to have you here. We are talking Monday morning, shortly before the open, and a lot of chatter still about Chairman Powell's appearance on 60 Minutes on Sunday. Did Chairman Powell say anything surprising to you that would make you rethink your asset allocation?
Chairman Powell has been unbelievably consistent, and there's no reason why he wouldn't be. Aaron, if you think about where we are, it's only April, right?
Right.
So even the most kind of optimistic, and I want to be optimistic. I want to come out of this pandemic, but even the most optimistic and, you know, glass half full type people can't imagine Jerome Powell doing anything but toting the party line that he's been toting for the past 3 or 4 months, even as the data underneath his chains. And what did we have just in the past week or so? We had the best ISM number we've had in almost 40 years. We have about 1 million more jobs with the revisions than we thought we had, you know, on the Good Friday payroll. And we have a gigantic auto sales number. And a record, Aaron, service sector ISM. So even with all of that, and even with people clamoring, just say something, there is no reason for him to not be continually bullish. I'm sorry, dovish with his remarks. And really, it all kind of begins and ends with his concept, Aaron, of this inclusive employment rate. And these are the two new things that they've introduced. The first is the average inflation targeting, which they've never done before, letting the economy run a little bit hot. And the second is what he's talked about over the past couple of months, which is, okay, we've seen jobs come back, but we need it to be more inclusive. And who knows what the definition of that is?
Right. He said, again, this was from 60 Minutes, we feel like we're at a place where the economy is about to start growing much more quickly and job creation coming in much more quickly. But then he also later added, we're going to continue to support the economy until the recovery is really complete. And I guess, you know, how do you define really?
Substantial progress, right, Aaron?
Yes, exactly.
We're all trying to figure this all out.
Yeah, so as a portfolio manager and you run a global macro fund, you can go anywhere in the world.
Yep.
Again, are you doing anything differently Monday morning based off of what Jay Powell said than you were doing Friday afternoon?
No, Aaron, I think it supports everything that we have in the portfolio right now. We don't have the most gigantic allocation to equities just in general. We've had more equity in the portfolio, Aaron, before than we do right now. We have about 64%. If you think about what our fund is, it's like a 60-40 type risk budget. We have about 64% equity. So not a ton of equity. But Aaron, we have clearly changed the way that we're allocating to places like the United States. And I think something as simple as changing from cap-weighted index exposure, which of course favors the biggest stocks, to equal-weighted S&P index exposure is something that we've never done before and something that we're introducing to the portfolio. And what that does is that just allows us to get access to things like more sectors like energy and financials and industrials as we see this economy improve. Aaron, we're embarking right now on the precipice. So we're right in the beginning of the second quarter. We believe that the second quarter of this year is going to be the strongest growth quarter, close to 9% annualized, that we've seen in a year of GDP growth that we haven't seen since the early 80s. So think about that. Right now, we're in the best quarter of the best year since the early 1980s. And what Jerome Powell is saying in terms of this patience, this incredible patience when it comes to economic monetary policy, just adds into the triple tailwind that we have of vaccine rollout. I mean, if the U.S. got an F last year in the pandemic, we're getting an A in vaccine rollout. The fiscal plan, which we've all seen, but the Georgia runoff was new information. Georgia runoff said Jerome Powell is going to have in his back pocket trillions of dollars of fiscal stimulus that no other G4 central bank has the luxury to have. And then the third piece, which not a lot of folks are talking about, which I think is critical here. Do you realize, Aaron, that the U.S. savings rate is at 15%?
Right.
That's the highest it's been dating back to 1960.
Yeah, so we haven't talked about that a lot, but it's a tremendous amount of money that hasn't been spent, and you got to think there's a lot of pent up demand as the economy.
As soon as you get the go ahead, it's like a traffic signal, right? You're driving down the road, you're at a red light. As soon as that light turns green, you're ready to go, and the American consumer is ready to go.
So you're kind of leaning towards energy, industrials, financials. Those sectors have already had, after very rough patches, sizable moves higher at the expense of the mega cap names that kind of led things in 2020. But what I'm reading from you is that you think that move is still early.
So that's a great question, Stephen. And I think what we'd have to see now, because of, as you mentioned, the move that's occurred in things like the multiples, what we'd have to see here is it play out in the earnings. As critical as this quarter is for our growth forecast, and I mentioned the 9% growth forecast that we have for this quarter, it's equally as important in validating in the earnings, not just the earnings, but the forward guidance. We need these companies to talk a lot like the tone that Jamie Dimon used in his letter last week, in terms of, you know, the ability for this reopening trade to stand the test of time, to not just be a shot in the dark, right? This has to be from a forward guidance standpoint, something that companies are very optimistic on, where we're going to see the earnings revisions ratios continue to go higher. That has to happen this quarter, and we're right at the beginning of earnings season, so we're really looking for that validation here.
Right, we should. I guess very quickly we should know, at least for the financials, we should be getting some of that information over the coming days. You also mentioned that you're modestly kind of underweight stocks. Where instead is that money? Is that in commodities?
Yeah, so we're not underweight. No, so we're not underweight stocks. We're still overweight. So I mentioned in a 60-40 parlance, we have about 64% of the fund in equity.
So you're not overweight stocks.
We're not as overweight stocks as we were at different points in history. And you know, at one point, you know, if you think about where we were in a year like 2017, when everything was just a global coordinated kind of response, EM was up close to 38% that year. You know, we had over 70% of our fund in equity. So it's not from this is the point I wanted to make with that. There is nobody coming on your podcast and saying, except unless they're an all fixed income person, unless they're a bond, you know, a bond curmudgeon, nobody saying don't be overweight stocks versus bonds. Everyone in the world is overweight stocks versus bonds. That's not going to cut it. I think what we're saying is, even though that beta trade, which is being overweight stocks versus bonds, is very consensus, the difference this year, Stephen, is going to be what is the size of your trade? And more importantly, what's the security selection? So that's why I wanted to kind of get into equal weighted versus cap weighted. We've introduced a 5% allocation to large cap value that we've never had in the portfolio before. Things like cruise lines, things like airlines that we've never had in the portfolio before. Small cap continued, not as big as where we were in the beginning of this year, but still, if we believe in a U.S. reopening trade, if we think that the second quarter is going to be a bout of U.S. exceptionalism, small cap should perform pretty well in that environment. And where have we taken money from? Emerging market equity. Emerging market equity, we came into this year thinking that the dollar would weaken, that the world would emerge from the pandemic. Instead, what we've gotten is a really formidable rollout of the vaccine here, more fiscal stimulus than what was once thought, a dollar that has rallied, but more importantly, very different from 2017. The EM equity index is a growth B type index, similar to what people are finding with cap weighted S&P 500 dominated by FANG. Instead of it being Apple and Facebook and Netflix, though, it's Tencent and Alibaba. So EM equity, we've downgraded to a neutral in favor of those US allocations that I talked about, but also Europe and Japan. Europe and Japan have a very high beta to cyclicality and value, things that have hurt it in the past. But as this rotation has been happening this year, you know, that's an overweight for us right behind where we sit in the US.
Right. So I wanted to ask you some, you know, tactically speaking, obviously there has been a huge rotation into the smaller caps and the value and cyclical names, let's call it roughly 6 months. This the last couple of weeks, though, you've seen a resurgence of some of the mega cap stocks. Do you think that's a you know, not to be too technical, a counter trend move within a larger theme? Or is there something going on where maybe people are saying, you know what, actually, I like Apple and I want to own Microsoft here, which, you know, obviously is in the news on Monday with this Nuance acquisition, but it came into the week at an all-time high. You know, Facebook's been perking up, and Alibaba, you just mentioned, rallying, you know, maybe because the Chinese government fined them. I don't know how to unpack that, but you know, there has been a rotation back to some of those mega caps in the last week plus. Do you think that's, you think that's temporary, I guess, is what?
So Aaron, this is the way I'll put it. We've been talking a lot about kind of cyclicality and value. We are not turning a fund into a value fund. What we're doing is we're neutralizing some of the heavy growth bias that we had into the fund up until the last few months. So once November 9th hit and everybody saw the news and Pfizer came out with a 90 plus effective vaccine, Moderna a week later, that's when we started to introduce this cyclicality and value to the portfolio. However, we still have growth managers in the portfolio, both in the US and abroad. Here's why we continue to have those in the portfolio, because those stocks, whether people like it or not, became duration trades. What do I mean by that? I mean that as rates rose, and we had two back-to-back months, basically, February and March, Aaron, where the 10-year Treasury jumped by 40 basis points a month, right? As highlighted by that crazy seven-year auction that occurred in February. So we had two back-to-back months of rates increasing pretty forcibly. That put a lot of pressure on the mega cap stocks. What we've seen over the past week, rates have stabilized. And as rates have stabilized, we've seen more of an appreciation for those mega cap names. And that's, whether people like it or not, they turned into duration trades most recently. Now, we do not expect to wake up on Memorial Day, okay, and see a 2% 10-year treasury. Now, 2020 and 2008 taught us never assign a zero probability any event. However, right. our base case is that we are not going to see the 10-year treasury from here deliver another 80 basis point move in the next 2 months. And this goes all back to Jerome Powell's bet that the inflation numbers are going to be transitory. And we would agree with that. We would agree with that because in order to get a really significant step up in the inflation regime. So everything that I've been painting has been reflationary. Reflationary means you have a, you know, low growth rates and low inflation rates, and you're getting back to trend, but in this case, above trend in terms of growth. What will cause inflation, what we would need to see to cause an inflationary backdrop, would be a big step up in wage inflation. And we don't see that as the case because even though we've seen all this job growth, the labor force participation rate is still 2 whole percentage points below where the participation rate was in January of 2020 pre-COVID. So what I'm saying here, although there's incredible amounts of labor demand, we've seen it in the JOLTS numbers, we've seen it in small business surveys, record numbers of small businesses saying that they're hiring. Of course they are, because the economy is reopening. But as the economy starts to reopen, we would expect, our base case is for labor supply to come back in. Labor supply comes back in, that should stunt wage inflation and prevent us really eclipsing reflation into inflation. But if we're wrong on that, that's when rates starts to rise. That's when financial conditions start to tighten. And that's when the Fed starts to get priced to lift off their federal funds rate sooner than 2023. All of this is really hinged on the Fed being on the sidelines from a federal funds rate standpoint until 2023. Now, they could taper. We expect them to taper. Right. We expect them to announce some sort of tapering by the end of the year.
So they have to taper first. I think that gets lost a lot in the conversation. They're going to taper before they raise rates.
That's correct. That's correct. So the sequencing we would expect to be similar to what we saw in the last cycle when they did a tapering announcement in 2013, and then they started raising rates. Janet Yellen started raising rates in December of 2015. So it could be tighter than that in this cycle. We've seen this cycle moving at breakneck speed, but tapering is not tightening. And if you actually just kind of divorce yourself from the taper tantrum and look at what risk assets did in 2013. Aaron, risk assets did really well in 2013, minus that 8-week period of the taper tantrum. But we have that experience now. And I think a lot of people, if we're at above trend growth, would be fine with the earnings story coming from equities in a world where Jerome Powell has to change tone at the tapering.
All right, we're talking with Phil Camporelli, he's a portfolio manager at JP Morgan Asset Management. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader.
Okay, welcome back to Alpha Trader. We're with Phil Camporelli from JP Morgan Asset Management. Phil, does your fund, are you allowed to invest in commodities? Because they've certainly been a hot area. And we just got talking about how your read and Jay Powell's read is there's plenty of labor on the sidelines. So there's no need to tighten anytime soon. So the money's going to keep flowing. Are you investing commodities?
Yeah, Stephen, good question. So we would consider commodities an alternative. Right, an alternative asset class. We do not allocate to commodities at this point. We would, though, if we believe that we were emerging from reflation to inflationary. We think commodities are an exceptional tool to manage inflation. I've been making the case that we're still squarely, our base case is that we're still squarely in a reflationary environment. In that environment, you want to own stocks over bonds, and within bonds, you want to own credit over ag or government bonds. Right. So nowhere in that mix right now for us is owning commodities. It just, you know, that we'd rather own risk assets in this environment rather than hedge against inflation.
Is Bitcoin or cryptocurrency included in alternative assets?
Yeah, that would be included in alternative assets. What we don't quite yet understand, and this is putting my kind of portfolio construction hat on, Stephen, we get this question a lot. What we don't quite understand yet or have an appreciation for is the diversification role that a cryptocurrency or a Bitcoin would have in a multi-asset portfolio. So we're still, you know, we know it goes up a lot and we know that it's pretty volatile. However, to use it as a diversifier, it's just not as compelling for us as something like government bonds or duration is to manage the downside. So we're still working on that. We get a lot of questions on Bitcoin, so we appreciate that consideration.
Right, and I would imagine you do get a lot of questions on it. And I should know we had David Kelly, who's chief global strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management, here a few weeks back, and he was pretty bearish on cryptos as a asset class.
Right. David Kelly, you don't want to, once David Kelly gets going on something that's, that he doesn't feel so good on, he'll tell you why.
Yeah, he sure did.
He's a great asset for us for sure.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was eye opening or ear opening on a podcast to hear him say it in such stark terms. But as a portfolio manager, I would imagine, you know, you're looking at some of the gains that have been occurred,
yep.
Whether you're on Bitcoin or Ethereum or Dogecoin or whatever other coin. Is there a FOMO feeling there?
Yeah, so we would consider it. We would consider those stocks more of like a an option. We'd want to own an option on it, a call option. Mm-hmm. And the volatility is so expensive right now on it because they move by so much. But again, going back to the question that Stephen was asking, we have to ask ourselves per unit of risk: does this offer a diversifier for us in a multi-asset portfolio? And we just don't have clarity on that just yet. Okay, so I think there's a lot of FOMO in this market, but we're going to really dedicate our risk budget to traditional equities at this point rather than the crypto side.
Got it. Okay, and I wanted to ask a follow-up on your comments about fixed income side wanting to own credit, mm-hmm. corporate yep. over government bonds. And am I right that you're preferring high yield within that?
Yes. So I just want to be really clear about something. This is not the high yield trade from last year at this time. Okay. We got an incredible entry point in both investment grade as well as below investment grade high yield last year, aided by the fact that the Fed, for the first time in I think 80 years, announced their intention to buy corporate bonds. I think that March 23rd announcement from last year, Aaron, is going to go down as the Fed's most creative and effective policy tool in history. If you go back to what that did, you know, it wasn't QE, it wasn't taking rates to zero. It was them coming in and saying they're going to be the buyer of last resort on the primary and secondary market for corporate bonds. That was amazing. And then the Thursday before Easter last year saying that they would buy high yield ETFs and fallen angels. This year, the reasoning for putting credit in the portfolio is to differentiate between the ag or the government bond portion of the portfolio. We're owning credit just for carry, not for total return. Success or failure on this fund is going to be driven by what we're doing on the equity side, the security selection, the sizing of our trades. But within fixed income, that's where we own the below investment grade credit. And we also own a pretty unique sector, Aaron, that we call crossover credit. So they're credits that cross over between the investment grade and the below investment grade sectors. And these are bonds that we think, if we're right about the recovery, there's some potential for rising stars. So those fallen angels from last year being upgraded into investment grade and us getting total return that way. And that was funded from very, very expensive investment grade corporates. So our largest fixed income allocation right now is in this niche sector of credits that we're choosing and believing can get upgraded if we're right about the recovery. And it's just a lower beta or lower risk way to play the recovery trade without having to buy equities. So it's a pretty unique sector for us that we're excited about.
Now, I'm curious, within that, is that across different sectors, these fallen angels, or is there a concentration in energy per se or some other sector?
Yeah, I would think about it as, you know, consumer discretionary or even, you know, airlines, industrials that got beaten up last year. Okay. And that got downgraded. So it's cross sectors, but it's, again, I want to be clear, it's right at the cusp of investment grade. Right. So you're talking about double B minus, triple B minus type names that we think could be upgraded back into IG if we're right about the recovery this year.
Right. And is there an ETF or a fund for retail investors who might want to look into this?
Not crossover. That's a pretty niche sector. It's kind of like securitized credit, which is non-corporate credit, which is another sector that we have in the portfolio. Not as big as crossover, but there is no ETF for it. We're using our quantitative beta strategies team to, you know, really screen these names for high quality names that we think could be upgraded. And again, it's our largest sector within fixed income, so it's a meaningful part of the portfolio.
Right, right. Yeah, so that's, you know, where security selection comes into play. And I guess maybe right. There's an opportunity there, but yeah, you know, that's for another discussion for sure.
Right.
So as long as we're talking about REITs, you know, the Multi-Asset Solutions Strategy Summit, JP Morgan, this is their team,
yep,
just had its quarterly meeting. And, you know, I'm looking at the notes that came out of that. And one of them is that we see a prolonged period of easy financial conditions, but a steeper yield curves.
Yeah.
How much steeper from where we are now? Because I heard you say you don't think that rates are going to jump up as they did for a couple of months here to start 2021.
Yeah, that's right, Aaron. So we think that the move that's been put in on the 10-year treasury, and as I mentioned, came into the year at about 1%, sitting just under 170 now. What that is, that's indicative and emblematic of this kind of reopening trade that we spoke about, the rollout of the vaccine, the fiscal stimulus plan. That's all being priced in at these levels. I think the next regime that we would expect over the next couple of quarters has to be kind of accompanied by a change in Fed tone. Now, we just spoke about how Jerome Powell is being very patient in terms of, you know, it being April 12th, right? And not changing his tone as we're still not quite reopened. But we think that eventually his definition of substantial progress, and that's the definition that he used in order to take some of the kind of the tapering away, the $120 billion per month of purchases, that is going to be satisfied as we get through the summer and into the fall. And he's going to start preparing for this kind of tapering effect. And that's when the kind of steeper curve comes in. So that's when yields do jump, because the economy can withstand it. Again, it might sound scary that the Fed is going to stop buying $120 billion per month at some point over the next 6 months or so. However, it's not. You want to be at the point where the Fed starts to normalize. Yeah, you want to be at the point where the Fed starts to normalize things. Now, it's going to be painful, but we do have the 2013 episode as an example. And in that example, tapering doesn't mean tightening. Tapering is a normalization process, and it has nothing to do with the federal funds rate, which is a whole nother set of circumstances that need to be solved for. So in that environment, while we may see a pause in the rise in rates now because the Fed's very patient, as we get into the summer, as inflation starts to really kind of level off around the Fed's target, and as the unemployment rate hopefully becomes more inclusive of people come back into the labor force, then we'll be at the point where, you know, the curves continue to steepen, which is a sign of good growth to come.
Got it. Because I wanted to ask you, as Stephen referenced earlier, bank earnings this week, really kicking off earnings season. Mm-hmm. A lot of big banks, including your employer, reporting later this week. The XLF is up almost 20% year to date. You have names like Wells Fargo and Bank of America up more than 30% year to date heading into this week. Are the financials pricing in a steeper yield curve sooner than you just described? Or do you think that they are, you know, relatively where they should be, for lack of a better way to describe it?
Well, I think, Aaron, as we saw last year with kind of the torrential outperformance of growth versus value, there was some catch up that needed to occur. And what sparked that was the vaccine. And I think that part of the move that you're describing has to do with the pro-cyclical aspect, and the other part has to do with the value aspect, which has the increase in rates. The forward guidance is going to be really critical here. What I think banks are pricing in is that the second quarter is going to be gangbuster. It's going to be 9% growth rate, and it's also pricing in, you know, kind of the jobs coming back. But what it's not pricing in, okay, is above trend growth that can continue into 2023. I'm sorry, into 2022. So that's not quite yet priced in. And that's something that we think can happen absent some sort of policy mistake, either from, you know, the monetary policy side moving too quickly, which we don't see, but I guess it could happen, or from kind of corporate taxation kind of picking up, which we also don't see. We could see it picking up a little bit, but not derailing the growth rate. So I think financials have priced in a really good outcome for the second quarter, but not beyond that. And that's where I think they're still upset.
Right. And you're still, just to be clear, you're still bullish on that group.
That's correct. That's part of our kind of large cap value move. You know, if you think about within small cap where the exposure lies, you know, financials is a bigger part of small cap than in large cap, and in equal weighted large cap terms, right? The equal weighted S&P, you get more financials than you would in a cap weighted S&P index exposure.
And I wanted to go back just quickly to something you said earlier, that the U.S. probably gets an A this year for its vaccine rollout. Certainly parts of Europe are probably more getting a C, D, or F on that.
Yeah, depending on how tough a grader you are. That's right, Steve.
Right. And is that a case for owning U.S. equities instead of European equities, or do you expect the European governments to kind of get their acts in order and maybe that's a bull case for Europe?
Yeah. So one of the really surprising things for a lot of folks has been the European outperformance this year. And the reason why that's happened, Stephen, has nothing to do with vaccine rollout, because, you know, as we've been talking about, they've had a couple of fits and starts when it's come to that. Now, we don't think it's canceled. Obviously, they're going to get their act together, and we're going to see that pro-cyclical growth happen. It's going to, as we say, move from forecast to fact. We've been saying that a lot these days, a little bit later than in the US, maybe in the third quarter. But what Europe has that's so incredible and what hamstrung them in prior years is this value orientation that everyone seems to want to get their hands on this year. So from an asset returns perspective, Europe is doing great versus the rest of the world. Japan is doing great versus the rest of the world, not because they're vaccinating, but because they have this value orientation that just does not exist in places like the US in a cap-weighted standpoint, which so many people are invested in, or in places like emerging markets, which we've also witnessed to be very, very growthy. So not vaccine related, but sector related. And that's where Europe and Japan have really shined this year, which is why for us, it represents just under 20% of our portfolio. And it's our second biggest overweight in the fund.
And Phil, before we wrap, and appreciate your time here this morning, this is more of a philosophical question. So maybe we'll go for a lot longer, depends. You cut your teeth as a fixed income manager. You're now in a global macro fund. Is there any part of you, you know, we're talking sort of nonchalantly about what Jay Powell said and the Fed, and they're going to keep tapering. It's only $120 billion a month. And yeah, we want it to stop. But there are people out there who really tear their hair out and say, this is insane. This is crazy. You know, the Fed is just, you know, going to destroy everything in its path and we're all doomed. maybe, you know, in a less dramatic way, like, what do you say to those people who are like, the bond vigilantes are coming back? Like, why do you think about all that?
Yeah, so I think about it pretty simply. The goals from 2008 with Chairman Bernanke and then Chairwoman Yellen and now Chair Powell, the goal has always been inflation. Always. So the goal was not to become Japan from the past generation. So these policymakers have done everything they possibly could. And again, it's not just Jerome Powell. this all started in 2008 with the financial crisis to build the Fed's balance sheet. And it was exacerbated in this cycle. Why? Because you had a pandemic.
Right.
There was absolutely nothing that was off the table for the Fed. Think about it. Think about it, Aaron. They bought corporate bonds, or they didn't even buy that many corporate bonds. But
they said they would. Just the signal. Yeah.
So they did something that would have been seen as incredibly controversial, buying public sector, private sector debt. Are you kidding me? So the whole goal here is to promote inflation expectations. And now they're at the point where they're saying they're going to let inflation run hot, the average inflation targeting part. So I give, listen, Jerome Powell has a ton of critics out there, and you mentioned a couple of reasons why. But I truly believe that I think he's absolutely right to not stand in the way of rates rising, because it does. I think it does promote confidence in the recovery. But B, I think that they would rather let the economy run hot than be perceived as choking off growth or inflationary expectations too early. So I'm going to give these guys the benefit of the doubt. But more importantly, Aaron, when it comes to asset prices and asset price inflation and the ability for assets to do well, you know, you have to take the information that's out there. And right now we have a very, very patient Fed, very, very easy monetary policy in a quarter that's going to be the best quarter of the best year since we've seen since the 1980s, along with the fiscal stimulus, along with the vaccine rollout, along with a record high savings rate. All of that is part of the formula for us to be overweight where we're overweight. And we've talked about it. So, you know, I grew up in fixed income, and I hang on every word that the Federal Reserve says. And, you know, they're not moving anytime soon. So we have to take that information and invest it in the market in that way.
Right. You got to play the hand you hand your dealt, but it doesn't sound like you're concerned or overly concerned that there's going to be runaway inflation or the dollar is going to become toilet paper and we're headed for the Weimar Republic or anything like that.
No, we don't believe that. If we believe that, then we'd have some other asset classes in the portfolio. You know, we're still the United States, as far as we know, we're still the deepest and most liquid capital markets in the world. And there's no alternative to that. And Congress people know that, and the Fed know that, but it's an important place for us to be. And the US dollar is strengthening this year because of this bout of US exceptionalism, not weakening. And that took a lot of people by surprise. So we are not of the ilk that we're heading down that road that you painted. And at some point, there's going to be a normalization process. Let's face it, we do have the Federal Reserve raising the federal funds rate. Okay. So it's not going to be, you know, zero forever. This is a world where the U.S. economy is going to continue to grow above trend. And we think into 2022, that allows the Fed to taper and then eventually to do liftoff. The Fed does not want to be at the zero lower bound. Okay. They've said that a lot. I think zero lower bound is the cliff that they're looking over. And if they didn't go to negative interest rate policy last year in the middle of the pandemic, they're never going to do it. Okay. Right. So they don't have any bullets left. So they want to get to a more normal policy, and similar to what they did from 2015 to 2018, we think that they're going to do that in coming years. That's really going to be the next level for financials. If you think about it, financials care more about the federal funds rate than they do a steeper yield curve. So that's coming in the future, you know, with some certainty for us.
I also think back. I might be getting my dates wrong a little bit here, but I think Powell is maybe a little bit scarred from what happened in 2018, and he's not going to make that mistake again. So I would agree.
That was bizarre, wasn't it?
Later rather than sooner.
I'll never forget that December of 2018. That December meeting was wild when he was just giving his press conference and the stock market was just falling like crazy. And then a couple of weeks later, he said, "You know what? We're actually not going to tighten policy anymore."
going to make that mistake.
Which is just crazy, but that's one of those lessons. I agree with you. To that Jerome Powell and with their average inflation targeting framework, I'm not sure if they even would have gone if Janet Yellen would have been able to go in 2015. So we're in a new regime right now of patience for sure.
Right, and like all of us, he learned on the job, it appears, and now it seems Jay Powell's a tremendous amount of credibility with the financial markets.
Yes, and very consistent message. But we, you know, once that message starts to change, which we expect it will towards the end of this year, as the substantial progress is satisfied, you know, he needs to keep his credibility. He can't just say that we don't have substantial progress with inflation, core inflation above 2%, and with the unemployment rate, you know, at 4 or 5%. He can't say that that's not substantial progress, and he can't continue to buy $120 billion a month. So, you know, that's the next inflection point that investors are going to have to deal with. But for now, you know, we like where we're sitting and kind of our overweights. And again, we're not turning our fund into a value fund. We're just introducing value to offset some of the heavy growth bias that we had in the portfolio through last year.
Right, and let's hope we get there, because that would be a very good story for the American economy and the American people if we are having that conversation in 3 or 6 months.
Yeah, and the data is validating it, Aaron. The data is not sitting on the sideline. You better buckle your seatbelt for this quarter, because we're going to see data that we haven't seen before, and it's going to be an exciting time. But you know, from an inflation standpoint, just not so fast. It's more of a growth story and earnings story that we're going to have to see validate our overweight.
All right, our guest has been Phil Camporelli. He's a portfolio manager at JP Morgan Asset Management. Phil, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, guys. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Phil.